Welcome to Saving Castles, the podcast for castle and chateau enthusiasts. Join us as we explore the fascinating history, stories, and culture of these awe-inspiring structures, from the legends and folklore to the latest in restoration. We'll cover it all, so whether you're a seasoned castle aficionado or just discovering the magic of these magnificent buildings, this is the podcast for you. So grab your headphones and let's dive in.
The early dawn in Acre was a thing of beauty and trepidation. The sky painted a surreal canvas of hues, the sun casting the first light over an ancient city engulfed in a battle between crusaders and the native populace. As the siege of Acre reached its crescendo in the late 12th century, a small group of German merchants and knights chose not to dive into the heart of the battle. Instead, they took on a different but equally vital mantle, that of healing. At first glance, this hospital brotherhood was no different from the several others that dotted the medieval landscape. Yet, from these humble beginnings, the Teutonic Order was born. Dedicated initially to the care of the sick and injured from the Holy Land, they soon transformed into a militaristic powerhouse, their emblematic black cross on a white cloak becoming a symbol, both dreaded and admired. The very evolution of the Teutonic Order symbolizes the volatile and transformative spirit of the Middle Ages. As Europe underwent profound changes, both spiritually and territorially, there was a need for new bastions of power and influence. The Teutonic Knights, or the Deutscher Orden, as they were called in their native tongue, quickly adapted to this shifting paradigm. From Acre's sandy shores to the snowy wilderness of the Baltic, their journey is a story of resilience, ambition, and a profound faith. But before we delve into the vast stretches of their northern exploits, it's crucial to understand their genesis. Picture the city of Acre, not as a mere battleground, but as a melting pot of cultures, ideologies, and ambitions. Here, amidst the minarets and marketplaces, the Teutonic Order found its initial purpose. Providing shelter and aid to pilgrims, they erected a hospital dedicated to the Virgin Mary. Their commitment to this cause earned them papal recognition and support, laying the foundation for a more militaristic role in the years to come. The Teutonic Knights' transformation didn't happen overnight. The journey from caregivers to combatants was shaped by the broader narrative of the Crusades. As the Holy Land became a hotspot of religious fervor and military conquest, the Order found itself being pulled into the vortex of power struggles. Their knowledge of the local terrain, combined with their growing reputation, meant they were no longer mere spectators. They were now formidable players. With this new mandate, their attire, too, evolved. Gone were the simple robes of caregivers, replaced by the heavy chainmail and armor of knights. Their emblem, the Black Cross, was not just an emblem of faith, but also a declaration of intent. It was a warning and a beacon, simultaneously signaling their unwavering faith and their readiness for combat. In this newfound role, the Teutonic Knights became crucial allies for many a crusading army. Their prowess in battle, combined with their extensive network of hospitals, made them indispensable. Their number swelled, attracting nobles, warriors, and aspiring knights from across Europe. By the turn of the 13th century, they were no longer a small brotherhood. They were an order, one that was rapidly expanding its horizons. Yet, their story in Acre was just the prologue. As the sands of the Holy Land witnessed the ebb and flow of empires, the Teutonic Knights set their sights on newer territories, beckoned by the promise and peril of the Baltic frontier. But that, dear listeners, is a tale for another segment. It is essential to understand that the story of the Teutonic Order is not just a chronicle of battles and conquests. It's a reflection of a time when faith, ambition, and geopolitics were intrinsically intertwined. A time when a simple black cross could inspire hope, incite fear, and ignite wars. Far from the sun-scorched landscapes of the Holy Land lay the enigmatic and frozen territories of the Baltic, a vast stretch of land and water, The Baltic region was the antithesis of Acre, in more ways than just its climate. Here, dense woods gave way to icy lakes, and the soft whisper of snowfall often drowned out the human narrative. Yet, this land held a promise that the Teutonic Order could not resist, the call of the last pagan tribes in Europe. The Baltic tribes, including the old Prussians, Lithuanians, and Estonians, lived in harmony with the stark nature that surrounded them. Their spiritual practices, deeply rooted in nature, revolved around the sun, the moon, and the many deities they held sacred. It was a world untouched by the central tenets of Christianity, a world the Teutonic Order believed was their divine mandate to transform. With papal blessings and fervent zeal, the Teutonic Knights began what would come to be known as the Baltic Crusades. These were not just wars of conquest, but missions of conversion. Yet, as is often the case, idealism met with stark reality. The pagan tribes, fierce and proud, would not bow down without a fight. Their guerrilla warfare tactics, combined with intimate knowledge of the terrain, made them formidable opponents. Every foray into this wilderness was a battle not just against the inhabitants, but against the very elements themselves. Knights, accustomed to the temperate climates of Central Europe, found themselves battling biting cold, treacherous terrains, and an enemy that seemed as fluid and elusive as shadows. Each expedition was a tale of heroism, sacrifice, and at times, despair. Yet, with every passing year, the knights made inroads. Armed with superior military technology and an unwavering sense of purpose, they began establishing footholds. And with every territory they conquered, they erected imposing castles, fortresses of faith in a land they believed they were destined to claim. These castles, often built overlooking strategic points, were not just military installations. They were symbols of a new order, both literally and metaphorically. With towering walls, moats, and battlements, they stood as defiant challenges to the old ways of the Baltic tribes. Within their walls, chapels were erected, and the sounds of Latin prayers began to resonate in the air, intermingling with the ancient chants of the land. For the tribes, the Teutonic Order's arrival was a cataclysmic change. Their sacred groves, where they once offered sacrifices to their deities, were slowly replaced by Christian churches. Yet, resistance remained. Across the Baltic, stories of heroes who stood against the might of the Teutonic Knights became legends. Tales of defiant standoffs, daring raids, and alliances forged in the heart of forests were whispered around campfires. The dynamic between the Teutonic Order and the Baltic tribes was complex. While knights viewed their mission as a holy endeavor, the tribes saw it as an invasion of their ancestral lands and beliefs. And amidst this tapestry of conquest and resistance, individual stories emerged of knights who began to respect and even admire the tribes they sought to convert, of tribal leaders who adopted Christianity but on their terms, and of common folks caught in the crossfire of faith and ambition. As decades turned into centuries, the boundaries between the conquerors and the conquered began to blur. The Teutonic Knights, initially alien to the Baltic landscape, slowly became a part of its intricate mosaic. Their castles, once alien structures, became central to the region's political and cultural fabric. By the end of the Baltic Crusades, the map of the region had been redrawn. Yet, it wasn't just a change in political boundaries, but a transformation of souls and societies. The Baltic, with its forests, lakes, and snows, bore silent witness to this metamorphosis as the chants of the pagan tribes slowly gave way to the tolling bells of Christian cathedrals. In the heart of what is today northern Poland, on the banks of the Nogat River, stands an architectural marvel that speaks of the glory, ambition, and indomitable spirit of the Teutonic Order. The fortress of Marienburg, known as Malbork Castle in modern times, is not just a castle, it's a testament to the Teutonic Order's might and vision. Imagine a sprawling complex of red-bricked walls, its towers touching the very skies, its battlements casting long shadows over the waters below. Marienburg wasn't built in a day, or even a decade. It was a labor of love, faith, and strategy, with each stone speaking of the tales of the knights who once called it home. Its construction began in the 13th century, serving as the order's headquarters, a bulwark against potential adversaries, and a beacon of Christianity in a land they had newly conquered. This fortress's sheer size was staggering, and its intricate defenses made it virtually impregnable. The moats surrounding it were deterrents not only to enemy armies, but also to the very idea of resistance. Every turret and tower was strategically placed, ensuring that any approaching adversary would find no blind spot. Within its massive walls, Marienburg was a hive of activity. At the heart of the fortress stood the Grand Master's Palace, an edifice of elegance and authority. From these chambers, decisions that shaped the destiny of vast territories were made. But Marienburg was not just about grandeur and governance. The daily life within its walls was a microcosm of the medieval world. The chapels echoed with Gregorian chants, where knights gathered for daily prayers, their armored forms kneeling in solemn devotion. In contrast, the castle's courtyards would often resound with the clashing of swords, as squires and knights honed their martial skills. Somewhere in a quieter corner, scribes, the unsung heroes of the medieval era, would be diligently recording events, ensuring that the order's exploits would not fade into oblivion. One cannot speak of Marienburg without delving into its architectural wonders. Its Gothic architecture, characterized by pointed arches and ribbed vaults, was not just about aesthetics. These designs had practical purposes. The high walls and slender windows, for instance, ensured that the interiors remained cool during summers and insulated during the biting Baltic winters. The fortress, while foreboding from the outside, housed gardens, reflecting pools and intricately carved statues, blending might with beauty. Marienburg was also a hub of diplomacy. Its grand halls have seen feasts that hosted kings, emperors, and ambassadors from distant lands. The clinking of goblets, the whispers of diplomats, and the soft strumming of lutes created an ambience where politics and culture seamlessly merged. Intricate tapestries depicting biblical scenes or the order's grand victories adorned its walls, providing a vivid backdrop to the power plays and alliances forged within. But every fortress has its secrets. Beneath the opulence of its halls and behind the serenity of its chapels, Marienburg held tales of intrigue. Whispered rumors spoke of secret passages, of dungeons where enemies of the order met grim fates, and of treasuries where unimaginable wealth was stored. Over the centuries, Marienburg, like the Teutonic Order itself, faced both glory and decline. It witnessed grand ceremonies, desperate sieges, and even moments of betrayal. But through it all, its walls stood resilient, echoing the ethos of the knights who built it. To visit Marienburg today is to step back in time. As you walk its ramparts, touch the ancient bricks, or gaze upon its spires, you're not just witnessing history, you're experiencing it. The fortress stands as a silent sentinel, its stones holding stories of valor, faith, ambition, and the ever-turning tides of time. The Teutonic knights, cloaked in their signature white mantle emblazoned with a stark black cross, were not mere warriors. Beneath the chainmail and armor, each knight embodied a complex tapestry of roles that made the order unparalleled in its time. From spiritual devotees to master diplomats, their reach stretched far beyond the battlefield, influencing the social, political, and religious fabric of medieval Europe. Imagine a knight, weary from battle, trading his sword for a rosary as he retreats to the sanctity of a chapel. This duality of monk and soldier was at the heart of the Teutonic Order. Their daily life was regimented, punctuated by the tolling of bells that signaled prayer times. The Latin chants, resonating in harmonious cadence, were as familiar to them as the clang of steel. It was this profound spiritual devotion that fueled their martial endeavors, making them not just conquerors, but also carriers of the Christian faith. However, while their commitment to Christianity was unwavering, the realities of managing vast territories necessitated another skill set, diplomacy. The intricacies of medieval politics, with its shifting alliances and treacherous betrayals, meant that the Teutonic knights had to be as adept in courtrooms as they were on the battlefield. The order's grand masters, in particular, were political maestros. Their vast network of spies and informants ensured they were always several steps ahead in the great chessboard of European politics. These grand masters deftly maneuvered between the Holy Roman Emperors, the Polish kings, and the Baltic tribes, forging alliances and treaties that secured the order's dominions. Imagine the grand halls of Marienburg, where a feast is in full swing. The hall is awash with the golden glow of torches, the air heavy with the aroma of roasted meat and fine wine. At the head of the table sits the Grand Master, engaging in hushed conversations with emissaries from distant kingdoms. Every toast made, every jest shared, and every deal struck under the guise of camaraderie had implications that would shape the destinies of nations. But the Teutonic Order's diplomatic endeavors were not limited to Europe. They established trade links with far-off realms, venturing as far as the Mongol courts in the east. Their fortresses became hubs of commerce, where merchants from different corners of the world converged, bringing with them exotic goods, tales from distant lands, and sometimes intriguing proposals of alliances. The order's intricate dance of diplomacy wasn't always met with success. There were instances of miscalculations, overreaches, and betrayals. There were moments when the knights found themselves isolated, surrounded by adversaries on all sides. But it was their ability to adapt, recalibrate, and forge new alliances that ensured their survival. Beyond politics and warfare, the Teutonic Knights also played a pivotal role in cultural exchanges. Scholars within their ranks translated manuscripts, ensuring the cross-pollination of ideas between the East and West. They sponsored artists and architects, transforming the Baltic region into a melting pot of Gothic, Romanesque, and indigenous architectural styles. However, this multifaceted role of the Teutonic Knights wasn't without its challenges. The very essence of their dual identity, monk and knight, often led to internal conflicts. There were those within the order who believed that their increasing entanglement in politics and commerce diluted their spiritual essence. Debates and dissent were common, especially when decisions made in the grand halls of power seemed at odds with the sermons delivered in chapels. To understand the Teutonic Order is to recognize this complex interplay of roles. They were not just warriors on a divine mission or astute diplomats maneuvering the corridors of power. They were a synthesis of these roles and more, and it was this very complexity that made their impact on medieval Europe so profound and lasting. As we peel back the layers of their history, we're reminded that the world they navigated was as intricate and multifaceted as they were. In the next segment, we will delve deeper into some of these challenges and the moments when the very identity of the order was put to the test. Within the protective confines of Marienburg's walls, where the Teutonic Order's heart beat with unwavering purpose, not all was harmonious. Beyond the grand narratives of conquests, diplomacy, and spiritual endeavors, the Teutonic Knights faced a battleground that often proved more treacherous than any they encountered in the Baltic forests, the battleground of their own beliefs and aspirations. Imagine the dimly-lit corridors of the fortress during the twilight hours. Here, knights and high-ranking officials would gather in clandestine meetings, their voices echoing with passion and dissent. The subjects, matters of faith, direction, and the very soul of the order. The challenges were manifold. First, there was the eternal struggle between the martial and the monastic. The foundational pillars of the order were anchored in both spiritual devotion and military might. But could a knight truly serve two masters? Could he plunge his sword into the heart of an enemy in battle, and then, with the same hands, lift a chalice in prayerful communion As the Order expanded its territories and influence, these questions became increasingly pronounced. Many believed that the Order's military successes were overshadowing its spiritual essence. There were murmurs, whispers that the Teutonic Knights were losing their way. Tensions heightened with the growing wealth and power of the Order. Vast territories and trade routes brought prosperity, but with wealth came corruption. The once austere and disciplined lifestyle of the knights began to give way to extravagance. Banquets in Marienburg became more opulent, the wine finer, and the feasts longer. Some knights embraced this newfound opulence, while others, more puritanical in their beliefs, saw it as a betrayal of their monastic vows. Another point of contention was the Order's treatment of the conquered Baltic tribes. While the Teutonic Knights prided themselves on being the bearers of Christianity, their methods often bordered on cruelty. Forced conversions, heavy taxation, and suppression of local customs led to growing unrest. Within the Order's ranks, a faction believed that they had strayed from their original mission of peaceful conversion. These dissenting voices argued for a more compassionate approach, one that respected the traditions and beliefs of the conquered. The political ambitions of the Order's Grand Masters further complicated matters. As the Teutonic Knights became key players in the geopolitical landscape of Europe, their alliances and treaties often put them at odds with other Christian states. Decisions made in the grand halls of Marienburg affected not just the fate of the Order, but the destinies of kingdoms and empires. The burden of these decisions and the inevitable fallout from wrong choices often led to internal power struggle. Imagine a tense conclave in the heart of the fortress. The Grand Master, surrounded by his inner circle, faces accusations from dissenting factions within the Order. Arguments flare, tempers rise, and the very fabric of unity threatens to tear apart. These were not isolated incidents. Throughout its history, the Teutonic Order witnessed multiple power struggles, with rival factions vying for influence. Yet, amidst these internal tumults, the Order displayed an incredible resilience. The very debates and disagreements that threatened to tear them apart also forged stronger bonds. The Knights were united by a shared purpose, a collective identity that transcended individual differences. They believed in the Order, in its divine mission, and in the promise of a united Christian Europe. As the sun set over Marienburg, casting the fortress in hues of gold and crimson, the knights would often gather in prayer. The chapel's serene ambience, the soft glow of candles, and the echoing chants served as a reminder of their shared purpose. It was in moments like these that differences melted away and the true essence of the Teutonic Order shone through. In the ensuing segments, we will journey through the external challenges the Order faced, battles that tested their mettle and determination. But it's crucial to understand that the Order's greatness was not just in facing external adversaries, but in navigating the treacherous waters of internal dissent and emerging stronger. As dawn's first light pierced the vast expanses of Eastern Europe, casting a golden hue across vast plains and dense forests, a potent challenge awaited the Teutonic Order. To the east of their burgeoning dominions, in the heartlands of what we now know as Lithuania, resided a powerful and fiercely independent pagan realm. The Lithuanians, unbowed by the Christian wave sweeping Europe, were the last significant pagan stronghold in a continent reshaped by the cross. Imagine for a moment the bustling heart of a Lithuanian settlement. Wood smoke wafted from thatched roof huts. The rhythmic beat of drums echoed in the distance, and shamans, their faces painted and adorned with intricate jewelry, performed rituals to honor ancient gods. It was a realm untouched by Christianity's influence, where old traditions held sway and the spirits of nature were worshipped with fervent devotion. To the Teutonic Knights, Lithuania represented the final frontier in their holy mission. If they could conquer and convert this land, then surely their vision of a united Christian Europe would be within reach But the Lithuanians were not to be underestimated. Under the leadership of formidable rulers like Mindaugas and later Vytautas, Lithuania forged alliances, expanded its territories, and became a force to be reckoned with. The battles between the Teutonic Knights and the Lithuanians were not just military confrontations. They were a collision of two worlds, two ideologies. When the steel-clad knights, their white mantles fluttering and black crosses prominent, charged into battle against Lithuanian warriors, it was as if the modern clashed with the ancient, the spiritual with the elemental. One of the most significant of these battles was the Battle of Sole in 1236. The Teutonic knights, underestimating their pagan adversaries, suffered a crushing defeat, shaking the very foundations of the order. The Lithuanians, exploiting their knowledge of the local terrain and using guerrilla tactics, outmaneuvered the heavily armored knights, leaving the field stained with the blood of the fallen. Yet, the Teutonic Order was nothing if not resilient. They regrouped, re-strategized, and rebuilt their forces. Over the years, a series of military campaigns, punctuated by truces and alliances, characterized the relationship between the Order and Lithuania. But as with all things in the medieval world, change was afoot. The conversion to Christianity of the Lithuanian Grand Duke Jogaila in the late 14th century and his subsequent marriage to the Polish Queen Jadwiga led to the formation of the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth. This political masterstroke transformed the balance of power in Eastern Europe. The Teutonic Knights now faced a formidable alliance that threatened to overshadow their dominion. However, the zenith of this conflict was yet to come. The year was 1410, and the plains of Grunwald bore witness to one of the largest battles in medieval Europe. On one side, the combined might of Poland and Lithuania. On the other, the Teutonic Order, in all its martial splendor. The Battle of Grunwald was not just a military confrontation. It was symbolic, representing the aspirations and destinies of nations. The dust of battle eventually settled, with the Teutonic Knights facing a defeat that would shape the course of their history. The once mighty order was compelled to reevaluate its position, leading to a series of treaties that reshaped the map of Eastern Europe. Through the tapestry of time, these battles, alliances, and betrayals between the Teutonic Order and Lithuania offer us a vivid tableau of medieval geopolitics. It's a testament to the enduring spirit of the Lithuanians and the relentless ambition of the Teutonic Knights. The air was thick with tension and intrigue as the mid-15th century dawned upon the Baltic shores. While the Teutonic Order had faced external adversaries in the form of the pagan Lithuanians and the allied forces of the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth, an internal tempest was brewing that would shake the Order to its very core. Envision the thriving coastal town of Gdansk, a jewel in the crown of the Order's territories. Its bustling ports witness the ebb and flow of trade, with merchants from distant lands bartering exotic goods amidst the chorus of seagulls and the distant hum of shipbuilders. Gdansk, however, was not just an economic hub. It was also a cauldron of simmering discontent. For years, the citizens of the town and the neighboring regions, collectively known as Prussia, had grown increasingly resentful of the Teutonic Order's authoritarian rule. The Order's imposition of taxes and monopolistic control over trade stifled the economic aspirations of the urban elite. Add to this the Order's persistent conflicts with Poland, and it became clear that a storm was on the horizon. In 1454, the tempest broke. The Prussian Confederation, an alliance of cities and nobility, openly revolted against the Teutonic Order and sought the support of the Polish king. The winds of war swept through the Baltic, signaling the beginning of the 13 Years' War. Picture the first skirmishes, the clattering of hooves, the deafening clash of steel, and the cries of warriors, both seasoned knights of the Order and the determined forces of the Confederation, aided by the Polish. But this wasn't merely a war of swords and sieges. It was also a battle of wits and diplomacy. Each side sought to forge alliances and capitalize on the fissures within the enemy's ranks. The Polish king, Casimir IV skillfully played on the internal divisions of the Teutonic Order, offering concessions to those willing to switch allegiances. The Order, meanwhile, tried to rally its supporters and reached out to the Holy Roman Empire and other Christian states, casting the conflict as a defense of Christendom against a rebellious force. The war, which raged intermittently over 13 years, was marked by a series of sieges, skirmishes, and battles. One such event that stands out is the Siege of Marienburg, the very heart of the Teutonic Order. The fortress that had stood unyielding for centuries found itself encircled and under threat. Imagine the desperation within those hallowed walls, the whispered prayers and the frantic preparations for defense. However, wars, especially those of such long duration, are also about endurance and resources. As the conflict wore on, both sides felt the strain. The Teutonic Order, already burdened by debt and stretched thin by the demands of warfare, found it increasingly challenging to sustain its efforts. Finally, in 1466, the bloody dance of war came to an end with the signing of the Second Peace of Thorn. The treaty's terms were a testament to the shifting power dynamics in the region. While the Teutonic Order retained some of its territories, including Marienburg, significant portions, including Gdansk, were ceded to Poland. As the ink dried on the treaty and the scars of war began to heal, the landscape of the Baltic had been irrevocably changed. The Teutonic Order, once the indomitable force of the region, had been humbled. The cities of Prussia, with their renewed ties to Poland, embarked on a new chapter of prosperity and autonomy. Through the echoes of history, the 13 Years' War serves as a potent reminder of the complexities of medieval politics, the ambitions of states and cities, and the ever-present tensions between rulers and the ruled. As our journey continues, we will delve deeper into the aftermath of this conflict and the twilight years of the Teutonic Order. Imagine, if you will, standing at the base of the towering Marienburg Castle, Malbork, its massive walls loom above, a deep red brick edifice standing in stark contrast to the cerulean sky. As you approach, the sheer scale and intricacy of the structure become evident. Battlements adorned with the black crosses of the order, soaring towers that pierce the heavens, and vast courtyards where knights once trained and prayed. Marienburg was the very heart of the order, a symbol of their power and prestige. But what went into building such a colossal fortress? The Teutonic Knights, drawing inspiration from their experiences in the Holy Land and their Western European origins, blended various architectural styles. Gothic spires and ribbed vaults coexisted harmoniously with the more austere and functional designs suited for defense. These castles, while serving as formidable military outposts, were also centers of administration, commerce, and faith. The region around the Baltic Sea, fraught with challenges and potential adversaries, necessitated a network of castles. Some, like Königsberg and Marienburg, grew to be sprawling complexes. Others, like the many smaller Ordensburg castles, dotted the landscape, acting as crucial defensive and administrative outposts. Yet beyond their martial exterior lay a world rich in art and faith. Step into the chapel of one of these fortresses, and you'll be greeted by the soft glow of candlelight reflecting off intricately crafted stained glass windows, painting stories of saints and martyrs. Frescoes, rich tapestries, and ornate altars all spoke of the order's dual commitment to faith and chivalry. But these castles were also hubs of innovation. The Order's engineers and architects were adept at incorporating the latest advancements in military architecture. Thick walls to withstand the newest siege engines, arrow slits and murder holes to deter attackers, and ingeniously designed gatehouses to trap invading forces, all attest to the Order's attention to detail and forward thinking. Moreover, around these fortresses, settlements often flourished. Merchants, craftsmen, and peasants, drawn by the stability provided by the Order's presence, set up homes, creating thriving communities. Thus, while the castles were symbols of the order's dominance, they also played a vital role in the socio-economic fabric of the region. One cannot speak of the Teutonic castles without touching upon their fate. Wars, time, and nature have all left their mark. The 13 Years' War saw several of these fortresses besieged, captured, and recaptured. Over the centuries, some fell into disrepair, while others were repurposed to fit the needs of changing times. Yet, their legacy endured. Today, these castles serve as poignant reminders of a bygone era. They attract historians, enthusiasts, and tourists alike, each drawn by the allure of their storied pasts. Walking through their echoing halls, one can almost hear the whispers of knights, the clanging of swords, and the soft murmurings of prayer. As the sun sets, casting these ancient stones in a golden hue, one can't help but marvel at the vision and ambition of the Teutonic Order. They were not just warriors and monks, they were also visionaries, builders, and administrators. In their castles, one witnesses the confluence of faith, power, and artistry. The amber glow of a setting sun gently caressed the ramparts of the once mighty Teutonic fortresses. As the 16th century dawned, the world around the order was rapidly evolving, and with it, the role and relevance of these warrior monks. The world had begun to shift. The medieval epoch, with its chivalric ideals and persistent skirmishes, was making way for the Renaissance, a period of rebirth in arts, sciences, and statecraft. The nations of Europe were coalescing into powerful, centralized entities, and the dynamics of power were more intricate than ever. Within this changing tapestry, the Teutonic Order found itself at a crossroads. The grand campaigns and conversions of pagan tribes were now tales of yore, and the political landscape in which the Order operated was fraught with new challenges. Gone were the days when the Order could rely solely on its military prowess. The heartland of the Order's power, Prussia, had been ceded to Poland after the 13 Years' War, turning the Teutonic Knights into vassals of the Polish crown. This was a humbling transition for an Order that had once asserted dominance over vast territories. However, as the proverbial night is darkest just before dawn, the Teutonic Order demonstrated an unparalleled ability to adapt. The warriors in chainmail began to don the robes of diplomacy and statesmanship. And at the helm of this transformation was a figure that history would not easily forget. Grand Master Albrecht of Brandenburg-Ansbach. Envision Albrecht, a young, ambitious, and well-educated member of the House of Hohenzollern. Recognizing the unsustainability of continued conflict with Poland and sensing the winds of change, he took a radical step. In 1525, with the Prussian homage, Albrecht secularized the order's Prussian territories, transforming them into the Duchy of Prussia, with himself as the Duke, a hereditary ruler. But this was no mere political maneuver. Albrecht, influenced by the Reformation that was sweeping Europe, embraced Lutheranism, signaling a profound departure from the order's Catholic roots. Prussia became the first state to officially adopt Lutheranism, placing it at the forefront of the Protestant Reformation. The ramifications of Albrecht's decisions were far-reaching. While it ensured a level of autonomy and stability for the Duchy of Prussia, it also led to a profound transformation of the Teutonic Order. The warrior monks, bound by vows of chastity, poverty, and obedience, now grappled with the challenges of governance, commerce, and diplomacy in a rapidly changing world. Yet, even in these twilight years, the Order's influence was palpable. Their administrative acumen, coupled with their commitment to the welfare of their subjects, set the stage for the emergence of Prussia as a dominant European power in the centuries that followed. But it wasn't just in the realm of governance that the Order left its mark. The cities and towns within their territories experienced a cultural and intellectual renaissance. Universities were established, arts patronized, and trade flourished. The blend of Germanic efficiency with Slavic resilience led to a unique cultural milieu that would influence European thought and politics for ages. As we trace the arc of the Teutonic Order's journey, it's evident that they were not merely relics of a bygone era. They were visionaries who could pivot and adapt to the tides of change. From the fervent crusaders in the Holy Lands to the master builders of magnificent castles, and finally to the enlightened rulers of a budding Renaissance state, the Teutonic Knights exemplified the spirit of evolution and resilience. As the final chapter in our narrative unfurls, we find ourselves amidst the echoes of history. The tale of the Teutonic Order serves as a testament to humanity's enduring spirit, resilience, and capacity to evolve. But what legacies have these knightly monks bequeathed to the annals of time? Let's start at the heart, the lands they once ruled. Today's northern Poland and the enclave of Kaliningrad, once the Order's Prussia, remain imbued with their influence. Wander the streets of Gdansk or Malbork, and you are traversing the very grounds the knights once tread upon. The grand castles, now either restored relics or haunting ruins, still dominate the landscape reminiscent of an age where faith and steel went hand in hand. But their legacy isn't merely architectural. The Teutonic Order laid the foundations for the emergence of the modern state of Prussia. This Prussian spirit, marked by discipline, administrative efficiency, and a penchant for innovation, would become the crucible for the creation of modern Germany, a nation that played a pivotal role in shaping the course of global events in the subsequent centuries. Culturally, the territories under their dominion became melting pots of Germanic, Slavic, and Baltic traditions. This confluence led to a rich tapestry of customs, arts, and languages that remains vibrant even today. From folk tales of brave knights to the intricate craftsmanship of the region's artisans, the Order's influence is inextricably woven into the fabric of Eastern European culture. Beyond tangible legacies, the Teutonic Knights serve as a parable for adaptation. At various crossroads of history, faced with existential threats and changing paradigms, the Order demonstrated a remarkable ability to reinvent itself. From religious warriors embarking on crusades, to master builders and administrators, and finally to statesmen navigating the complexities of Renaissance Europe, their journey is a lesson in resilience and evolution. Their spiritual journey, too, is noteworthy. An order rooted in the Catholic tradition, championing its cause for centuries, eventually became the harbinger of Protestantism in Prussia. This transition, sparked by the Reformation and championed by figures like Albrecht of Brandenburg, Anspach, showcases the Order's flexibility and its alignment with the zeitgeist of the times. Yet, for all their achievements in adaptability, the Order serves as a poignant reminder of the impermanence of power. Once the masters of vast territories, the stewards of Christianity in the East, and the architects of monumental castles, they eventually receded into the backdrop of history. Their story underscores the ebb and flow of empires, orders, and dynasties, each leaving behind indelible marks, yet none immune to the inexorable march of time. As we close this chapter on the Teutonic Order, let us reflect on their tale not just as a historical account, but as an allegory of human endeavor, of the synthesis of faith and might, of the beauty of cultural confluence, and of the transient nature of power and glory. The knights, in their chainmail and surcoats adorned with crosses, might have vanished into the mists of time, but their legacy, etched in stone, culture, and spirit, endures. So, dear listener, as you stand before a Teutonic castle, let the winds whisper their tales. Tales of valor, faith, ambition, and metamorphosis. And may you carry forth the lessons and stories of the enigmatic Teutonic Order, the true Knights of Shadows. Let us pause and appreciate the enduring legacies of the Teutonic Order that still stand sentinel across the landscapes of Eastern Europe. Their castles, these monumental structures, were not mere fortresses. They were tangible embodiments of the Order's aspirations, might, and commitment to the Christian faith. We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Saving Castles podcast. Stay tuned for our next episode, where we'll continue to explore the fascinating world of castles and chateaus. Don't miss out and subscribe to our podcast to get notified when new episodes are released. For more information about us and our work, visit savingcastles.com. Thank you for listening.